This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, February 13, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. NATO calls off talks over the protection of Turkey on the eve of tomorrow's report by Hans Blix to the Security Council. In Baghdad, Iraqis remember the last Gulf War when the US bombed nuclear protection shelters. And the Democrats are threatening to filibuster the nomination of Miguel Estrada to the US Circuit Court of Appeals. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Japanese defense minister said today that if they had firm evidence that North Korea was going to launch an attack against them, they would strike first. Minister Shigeru Ishiba said he distinguishes this from a preemptive strike by calling it a self-defense measure. Tensions are high over the situation between North Korea, with the second largest standing army in the world, and the United States, with the most expensive. North Korean officials have said they would consider any sanctions against them for starting up a nuclear power plant they say they must have for energy would be considered an act of war. Today, Assistant Secretary of State James Kelly said the U.S. would not support economic sanctions against North Korea at tomorrow's U.N. Security Council meeting.
The Security Council is going to be more in identifying it as a problem rather than in prescribing some particular action or sanctions that North Korea would have to do. But I don't know that. We'll just have to see how it unrolls at the Security Council.
Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld said today he would not rule out the U.S. use of nuclear weapons in a possible war with Iraq. Rumsfeld added that he believed anything that needed to be done in Iraq could be done with conventional capabilities. Today, the German chancellor explained his position for blocking the NATO guarantee to protect Turkey in the event of a U.S.-led attack against Iraq. Wait for weapons inspectors to complete their job before committing to war. Jörg Ratsch has more from Berlin.
Gerhard Schröder here in Berlin made clear again, under his government, there will be no German participation in any military action against Iraq. Schröder stressed that he still believes in a chance for a peaceful solution of the conflict. In his view, there has been no evidence so far that Iraq has anything to do with terrorism. We need more and ongoing weapons inspections in Iraq, Schröder said in his resolute speech before the Bundestag. What we don't need is to get used to war as a normal means of politics. In Berlin, I'm Jörg Ratsch for Free Speech Radio News.
A lawsuit filed in federal court in Boston today claims that President George W. Bush does not have the authority to invade Iraq without a congressional declaration of war. From Boston, Chuck Rosina reports.
A lawsuit filed in federal court in Boston today claims that President George W. Bush does not have the authority to invade Iraq without a congressional declaration of war. The plaintiffs, including a member of the Massachusetts National Guard and the Massachusetts Air Force Reservist, as well as six members of Congress, claim that the congressional resolution on Iraq last October did not specifically declare war and unconstitutionally gave the president the right to make that decision. Democratic Congressman John Conyers of Michigan and Dennis Kucinich of Ohio are leading the effort. The lawsuit names Bush and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld as defendants. However, with the precedence of U.S. military actions of the latter half of the 20th century, including Korea and Vietnam, it is not likely that such a lawsuit would, in and of itself, stop Bush's plans to invade Iraq, but it is one more effort in the mounting resistance to go to war. There has been no comment from the White House. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina in Boston.
Lucio Gutierrez, the new Ecuadorian president, spoke at a breakfast meeting sponsored by the Council of Americas in Manhattan today. He and other Latin American leaders are meeting with businessmen in New York City and discussing how to better affect government through methods that some say abandons their country's poor. Carlos Fabrara reports from WBAI.
After meeting with President Bush on Monday, President Lucio Gutierrez, the first Ecuadorian president to be invited to the White House in many decades, declared that he wants to make Ecuador the United States' best ally. Today, Gutierrez sang a similar tune to some of the United States' biggest corporations, like American Express, Chevron Texaco, and Citibank, as he made the case for a stable, safe investment environment in Ecuador. Companies like Chevron Texaco have been sued by Ecuador's indigenous people for past environmental disasters. Miles Frochet, the director of the Americas Society, where the event was hosted this morning, says they have hosted many Latin American presidents before.
The Council of the Americas promotes trade, investment, democracy, and the rule of law.
Yet some analysts reject the Council's claim of promoting democracy in Latin America, calling it contradictory and citing links between the family of conservative Venezuelan media mogul Gustavo Cisneros, whose wife sits on the Council board. Cisneros has been one of the leaders of the strike against Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, using his television station to promote the downfall of democratically elected President Chavez. In New York City, I'm Carlos Favara.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
As we reported in the headlines, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld today said the U.S. would not rule out the use of nuclear weapons in a war on Iraq. This is today NATO called off talks which have been stalled over the issue of protecting Turkey in the case of a war on Iraq. William Hartung is a senior research fellow at the World Policy Institute. He sees this issue as very serious.
Well, it's a huge rift in NATO, and it's really been caused by the Bush administration, because basically, under the guise of providing protection to Turkey, they were trying to force NATO members to endorse the notion of war with Iraq. And what Germany and France and others have said is, we're not going to endorse defense of Turkey until it's been decided by the UN Security Council whether there should be a war in Iraq. And that's been really the basis of the dispute. Donald Rumsfeld has poured salt in the wound by talking about the old Europe and the new Europe, and the United States, no doubt, has been offering favors and aid and who knows what to some NATO members to come along with the United States position.
What do you think this means for NATO's future?
Well, I think NATO is in trouble. There was always a question at the end of the Cold War of, if there was no Warsaw Pact on the other side, why did you need a NATO? And the arguments were NATO would provide political cohesion in Europe. It would be a vehicle for joint military ventures by the United States and key European allies. But other than in the Balkans, where NATO did function as a military unit, ever since then, in Afghanistan, NATO endorsed siding with the United States, taking military action. They were not allowed to do so as NATO, only as particular countries doing what Donald Rumsfeld and the administration felt they wanted them to do. So I think in an era when the United States is looking to fight a whole series of wars against tyrants, terrorists, people who they think are getting weapons of mass destruction, and they want to do it without necessarily the approval of the UN or any other body, I think this kind of division in NATO is probably just going to get worse.
Now, what implications do you think this could have for tomorrow when Chief Weapons Inspector Harmblix makes his presentation to the UN Security Council?
Well, there'll be another round of pressure on France and Germany from the US and the UK after Blix's presentation. It sounds like Blix doesn't have any major new revelations, except that perhaps Iraq has some missiles that have a greater range than they're allowed under the sanctions and the post-Gulf War resolutions, but no indication that Iraq is an imminent threat to its neighbors, certainly not to the United States. So Colin Powell and others are going to try to take whatever Blix offers and use it to force France and Germany to endorse war. They're probably going to hold their ground, and there's probably going to have to be some sort of compromise resolution in the UN where the implications are kept a bit fuzzy, or possibly the U.S. just deciding to go ahead without a UN resolution.
And finally, we've seen today Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld say that the U.S. will not rule out the use of nuclear weapons in a war on Iraq. How serious is this?
Well, for some time it's been U.S. policy not to rule out the use of nuclear weapons. But the Bush administration has embraced this notion with great enthusiasm. They repeat it frequently. They're in the context of developing nuclear weapons that can get at underground hardened bunkers. Their whole nuclear strategy document basically talked about striking countries, whether or not they have nuclear weapons, whether or not they're using weapons of mass destruction against the United States, for a whole variety of strategic and military purposes. So I think in that sense, it's quite serious. Even the use of that kind of rhetoric at a time like this, I think, is unduly provocative. But I'm I tend to doubt that the United States will use nuclear weapons in this conflict unless Iraq attacks Israel with chemical or biological weapons. Israel responds in a nuclear fashion. There's certainly a possibility that it could run out of control. But I think for the moment, it's rhetoric. But it's the kind of rhetoric that is going to convince other countries that they had better get nuclear weapons themselves if they don't want to be threatened by the United States at some future date. So I think it's very counterproductive in terms of what should be the goal of reducing nuclear weapons around the world.
William Hartung, Senior Research Fellow at the World Policy Institute. On this day, February 13, 12 years ago, two U.S. bombs directly hit a Baghdad nuclear shelter during the Gulf War. Originally designated as one of Baghdad's 34 nuclear shelters, no one imagined that a purported sanctuary from war would become a death trap. Nor did any Iraqi civilian anticipate that the Pentagon would deliberately target the structure. FSRN correspondent Ben Granby filed this report on the anniversary of the shelter bombing, which claimed the lives of 408 Iraqi civilians, mostly women and children.
As the first bomb punctured the roof, just above where hundreds of women and children were huddled, a second bomb was guided directly into the air vents. The heat of this second blast turned the two-story shelter into an oven, and 408 people perished in the 400-degree heat, with only 14 survivors. The United States claimed that the shelter doubled as a command and control center for the Iraqi military, and only weeks later admitted its mistake. 12 years on, as America gears up for another massive attack on Iraq, the memory of the Amiriya shelter strike takes on an immediate relevance for Iraqis. Every year, Sahara returns to the shelter to pay her respects to her sister Samira and her six nieces and nephews who perished here.
When I came here and visit this place, I return back to the memory, and I feel that what happened here is very difficult.
On February 3rd, the New York Times released reports that the Pentagon was planning a massive bombardment of over 3,000 cruise missiles on Iraq's capital. But the use of precision munitions gives few residents here much comfort.
You'll hit us with another smart bomb. You have smart bombs, but you don't have smart leaders.
Ghazwan al-Mukhtar, a retired anti-sanctions campaigner, thinks that it'll be futile to hide from the next war.
I myself would not use the shelters, but I'm not going to leave. I'm going to stay here. Because you would be bombing, carpet bombing all over Iraq. So it doesn't make a difference whether you die in Baghdad or you die in Basra or you die in the desert.
Many in Baghdad carry an air of fatalism when discussing what they may do if President George Bush launches his new war. The memory of the 1991 bombing at Amiriya gives many Iraqis the impression that it would be fruitless to seek shelter. Abdel, a local hotel clerk, reflects on this.
I'm not believing in shelter. Why? Because it's no way when the time for dying is come. It's come. Shelter's there or not shelter.
As the past generation has seen two major wars, 12 years of crippling sanctions, and the threat of a third conflict, many Iraqis have turned to their faith for comfort. 23-year-old Reem, a worker at the Islamic Relief Agency, believes that most consider their destinies to be out of their hands.
I know many people, they do not think to go to shelter. People, just as you can say that, they become with strong belief, and strong belief in God gets stronger, our ties with God. They believe very much that God is the one who decides the life of people, not missiles, not American missiles.
On the 12th anniversary of the Amiriya shelter bombing, families and victims pass through silently paying their respects. A colorful wreath starkly contrasts against the gray tone of shattered concrete and twisted steel. Shadows of visitors walking by are cast against patches of melted human remains embedded where they burned to death. Beth DePonte, who in 1992 compiled an estimate of civilian casualties for the U.S. Department of Commerce Census Bureau of Foreign Countries, had estimated that 13,000 civilians were killed, not including many times more who died as a result of targeting of infrastructure and the shortage of food and clean water. While any estimation of casualties in a new war appears speculation, the insistence of Baghdad citizens to remain in their homes could have critical ramifications. The Pentagon's plan for attack may involve, in just a few days, 10 times the total number of precision bombs that were dropped in 1991. As the National Defense University noted while drawing up these plans, nothing this massive had been seriously considered before. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ben Granby in Baghdad.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. The campaign opposing military action against Iraq is rife on the streets of Kingston, Jamaica. A group calling itself Jamaicans Against War staged a peaceful protest yesterday just outside the National Stadium, where the American soccer team was playing a friendly match with Jamaica. Patrick Scudder was at the stadium in Kingston and files this report.
That's the sound of the festive atmosphere inside Jamaica's National Stadium yesterday, where fans gathered to see their team take on the United States. Hours before the game, a much smaller group of Jamaicans took on Uncle Sam. They gathered at the Bob Marley statue near the stadium, displaying placards denouncing the impending war against Iraq. They encouraged football fans to sign a petition against the war. Most Jamaicans who attended the game didn't bother to sign up. But there were a few who did, and they have strong views about America's motives for invading Iraq.
You guys here to see the game?
Yes.
Have you been taking note of what's happening out here with the people protesting against the war? What do you think about it?
I think that what they're doing is good. Because the fact of the matter is, the United States has decided to take a decision, and it seems to be a unilateral one as far as I can see, where even though world opinion is against it, they have decided to go ahead anyway and attack Iraq. I mean, that there are questions in my mind as to the real purpose behind it, to be honest. I'm not so sure it's about terrorism as much as it is about the oil that is in Iraq.
People all over the world show their protest against his action, President Bush's action, is basically wrong, totally wrong. Yeah. He's just being a bully, basically.
John Maxwell is a columnist for one of Jamaica's daily newspapers, and he's one of the organizers for the protest. Mr. Maxwell says the petition will be presented to Jamaica's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He says it was important to carry out this action, although Jamaica was a small island in the Caribbean with no economic or military power.
I don't think the Third World as a whole has done enough to say how they feel, because I think everybody's afraid of the United States of America. You know, my feeling is that I am not putting up with that. I am not going to surrender my autonomy and my sovereignty without a fight. And as far as I'm concerned, justice is indivisible. And if you take advantage of Iraqi children, you're taking advantage of Jamaican children.
The group says they will ask the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to pass their petition on to its permanent representative at the United Nations. The petition called on America not to act alone and to work with members of the UN to engage in serious committed diplomacy to resolve the Iraqi conflict. There were some Americans among the protesters, and they agree that the Bush administration should use more diplomacy with the rest of the world to solve the Iraqi standoff.
No, I'm here because we once operated a preparatory school and a university in Baghdad, and I know thousands of people who live in Baghdad, and they're innocent people, and I'm just in solidarity with them. That's all.
Jamaicans Against War says they staged the demonstration at the stadium to take advantage of the media corps, who will be there to cover yesterday's game. The group says they will mount another peaceful protest in front of the consulate section of the American Embassy this weekend. In Kingston, Jamaica, I'm Patrick Scudder for Free Speech Radio News.
Congressional Democrats have chosen to stand and fight on at least one issue in this new Congress, the nomination of conservative attorney Miguel Estrada to sit on the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. The White House is refusing to release documents Democrats say might reveal Estrada's position on some hot-button issues. The Democrats have threatened a filibuster, and they think they have the votes. Josh Chaffin has more from Capitol Hill.
Bush nominee Miguel Estrada has the American Bar Association's highest rating. He was the head of the Harvard Law Review, a Supreme Court clerk, a federal prosecutor, and an assistant U.S. Solicitor General who argued 15 cases before the Supreme Court. Estrada is a member of the law firm that represented Bush in the Supreme Court fight for the presidency. Republicans are furious he hasn't been confirmed.
Miguel Estrada's nomination has been pending for 18 months.
Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist calls the Bush nominee the embodiment of the American dream.
If confirmed, he would be the first Hispanic to ever serve on a D.C. on the D.C. Circuit Court, a court many consider to be the second most important in the United States.
Democrats opposed to Estrada have threatened a filibuster, the name for a long floor speech designed to stall the legislative process and derail a vote. This tactic is rarely used, but Democrats like Edward Kennedy see Estrada's nomination as the first of many battles over judicial nominations, many of which they'll likely lose, being the minority in Congress.
The D.C. Circuit is the second most important court in the country. It has a unique and prominent role among the federal courts. Its decisions have immense influence over civil rights, over workers' rights, over environmental protection, and many other major issues facing the country. And these basic rights are clearly in danger if judges on the D.C. Circuit are bent on restricting them or undoing them.
Estrada was born in Honduras, but he's opposed by the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, not to mention the Congressional Black Caucus and the NAACP. Chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Utah Republican Orrin Hatch.
Fact of the matter is there's a different standard being used against Miguel Estrada. And I suspect it's because, not because he's Hispanic, but because he's an Hispanic Republican who may be conservative, who might even differ with some of our colleagues on some of their pet issues.
But it's those maybes and might-bes that have Estrada's critics worried. The Democratic minority in the Senate says they don't know Estrada's positions on many issues because they say he evaded their questions before the Judiciary Committee last year. He hasn't stated for the record what he thinks of the landmark abortion case Roe v. Wade and of Romer v. Evans, the case that struck down Colorado's anti-gay rights measure. That's brought down the full force of the National Organization for Women, the Feminist Majority, the National Women's Law Center, Planned Parenthood, and the progressive think tank People for the American Way, whose president is Ralph Neese.
If someone wants to be on the court in a lifetime position, then that person should be willing to demonstrate a commitment to equal justice under the law, to fundamental civil rights and civil liberties principles.
Democrats say they'll filibuster until Estrada answers their questions. They're also demanding to see internal memos he wrote as an assistant U.S. Solicitor General. In a letter to Democrats yesterday, the White House refused to release those documents. Ralph Neese wonders what's in there.
The former Deputy Solicitor General said last year that he did not think that Estrada was qualified to be on the circuit court because he was such an ideologue, and when he was in the Solicitor General's office would bend the facts to suit his ideology. So it could be that some of these memos that he wrote while in that office would reflect that.
The choice of Miguel Estrada for the D.C. Circuit Court is also opposed by the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, Earth Justice, the Sierra Club, and the AFL-CIO. Democrats say they have the votes to filibuster his nomination. The fight looks likely to go on into next week. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Capitol Hill.
Tenants from public housing projects in New York, Washington, D.C., and Baltimore, many of them elderly, disabled, or with small children in tow, rallied yesterday to protest a 30% cut in funding for public housing. Organizers of the rally called the cuts some of the worst in recent history and say they'll jeopardize virtually all services for tenants who live in public housing, including childcare, job training, education, and public safety. Tom Gomez from WBIX Refugees and Exiles Radio has the story.
In D.C. alone, over 30,000 low-income residents live in public housing, including over 10,000 children and 5,000 seniors. Those tenants will lose over 1,000 child care slots and see the elimination of summer youth employment programs sponsored by the district's housing authority. Officials at HUD say the cuts come as a result of what tenant leaders are being told was a mistake by the agency in managing its funds for 2002. That mistake has frozen funding for 3,200 local housing authorities at 70% of what they are due until HUD can untangle its budget situation, something officials at the agency have said will happen sometime next summer. But those at this rally were not convinced by those assurances. Many felt that they were being made to pay the price for a U.S.-led war in Iraq, a war most of those here today oppose.
Early to bed, early to rise, work like hell and organize.
Money for homes, not for war. Money for homes, not for war.
Washington, D.C. is a prosperous city, where one in five city residents was forced to live in poverty last year. It has one of the tightest housing markets in the nation, with less than a 1% vacancy rate. Linda Leakes is a tenant organizer with Washington Inner City Self-Help. Like other community housing activists, she feels the government needs to spend more, not less, money for housing. Yesterday, she was among the over 200 demonstrators to take the street to demand that Congress restore full funding for public housing.
We have to get rid of poverty. We have to give people jobs that pays them enough money to live a quality life. We have to take profit out of housing. We have to take profit out of health care. We have to take profit out of those things that people need to live and survive in this world. Public housing already is the housing of last resort. That's where people go right before they go to the streets.
Three times as many people are homeless here than the national average, including over 3,400 children last year. That means that over 20,000 local residents are on long waiting lists for government-subsidized public housing, some for years. Marianne Luby is with the Washington Legal Clinic for the Homeless.
I'm here because homelessness and the lack of housing are very, very much related. And here in the District of Columbia, public housing is the only place people who have very little resources can go to live. If HUD moves forward with this budget cut, it will impact not only the people in public housing because repairs will not be made, units will not be turned over. It will also impact the people who are on the waiting list, who are waiting and waiting and waiting and will be waiting longer.
Cities across the nation are being forced to cope with rising homelessness. The New York Times reported on December 5th that homelessness has risen in America by 19% since the start of the Bush administration. Like many of the over 200 people to come out to yesterday's protest, Annie Chambers is a senior citizen concerned about that rise. She lives in public housing in Baltimore, a city that's been particularly hard hit by the increase.
We're having so much homeless in our city. It has tripled in our city. But not only that, our houses are falling down all around us. So we don't even have money to fix up what we have.
New York City residents were among those out in front of HUD yesterday to hold officials accountable for cuts they say public housing residents, many of whom live on fixed incomes, cannot afford. Ethel Velez made the four-hour trip on the bus with her 10-year-old granddaughter.
Same reason we come down here, because of the budget cuts that are going to be so devastating to our housing authority, and the fact that improvements can be made, but we're constantly being cut and things being taken away, that we cannot make any progress in public housing.
D.C. seniors like Beatrice Tinsley felt that the U.S.-led war on terror has become a war whose victims here at home include the elderly and the poor.
I came out today because I think it's unfair for what they're trying to do to the senior citizens. And there are so many homeless people here in the District of Columbia that should not be. And they keep talking about terrorism. It's terrorism what they're doing to these people.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tom Gomez reporting from Washington for WBIX Refugees and Exiles Radio Network.
Free Speech Radio News is produced by Cutta Mesta at the studios of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. Headline editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram at WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Technical producers are Jade Paget-Seekins and Pauline Bartolone at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley. Josh Chaffin is our DC editor at Pacifica Station WPFW. Web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. You can visit FSRN online at www.fsrn.org. I'm Deepa Fernandez.